Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today's program will be a discussion of when should we recognize something as a property right. Today's moderator is Satya Marar, postgraduate research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so we'll be able to access them later. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Satya, thank you so much for joining us today and for moderating today's discussion.
Hey, thanks for that. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the American Republic, we recall that America's constitutional experiment began with one of many striking propositions, that the new republic would protect not only land, ships, tools, and goods, but also products of the mind. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited time exclusive rights for authors and inventors in their writings and discoveries. This is a remarkable clause not merely because it authorizes copyright and patents, but because it embeds IP not simply as a policy proposition, but within the constitutional theory of ordered liberty, republican self-government, and economic dynamism. It treats creativity and invention as public goods worth encouraging, while also limiting the duration and purpose of exclusive rights. The idea isn't that ideas themselves should be owned in the way you own a farm or a house. It's a subtler premise that a society that wants learning, invention, expressive culture, industrial progress, and technological diffusion must sometimes grant legally enforceable rights over intangible assets. Those rights channel private initiative towards public ends, giving authors, inventors, firms, and investors enough control to risk time and capital. They allow trade, licensing, specialization, and markets to flourish. They create incentives to disclose rather than to conceal useful ideas. But they also carry dangers. Monopoly, rent-seeking, suppression of flow-on innovation, and overclaiming of what belongs within the common stock of knowledge. The modern debate over AI, data markets, and so on have returned us back to a deeper question than IP. When should the law recognize something as a property right? The answer can't simply be whenever something has value. Facts, ideas, language, scientific truth, and human style all have value, but they can't all be enclosed. Nor can the answer be only when the exclusion costs nothing, because every serious property regime imposes some social costs. The four main questions situations seem to come down to is the right to exclude necessary useful to induce valuable creation, investment, coordination, disclosure, or personal interests? Are the boundaries of the property right that we're going to create administrable by courts, tribunals, and regulators? Will a new right increase or reduce transaction costs on net terms, or change the transaction cost burden unduly in favor of one side or the other? And would giving the rights holder this degree of control, what would the implication of that be for free speech, competition, science, democratic culture, any number of policy considerations? To help us answer and clarify current debates around expanding or scaling back the scope of property rights, we have today three great experts. First, we have Alden Abbott, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and a former General Counsel at the FTC. Professor Jane Bambauer of the University of Florida, where she teaches law and journalism, and Jeffrey Depp, Senior Counsel for Law and Policy at the Committee for Justice. I'm your moderator, postgraduate research fellow at Mercatus, Satya Marar. So with that, let's kick things off. Jane, what makes property rights different from other kinds of rights, such as under tort, contract, or statute?
Yeah, I've given this a lot of thought because even though I cannot claim to be a property theorist or really even a property law scholar, and I'm going to rely on Jeffrey and Alden to help us, you know, kind of elevate the discussion on that side, I have found that by writing about privacy law and about free speech, the conception of information as property has been, you know, has for decades now been sort of creeping in and causing kind of some tension and some some kind of intellectual fuzziness in these areas. So I think what's key to property, and this is debatable among property scholars, but I think it's clear that the main key right involved with property is the right to exclude. So if somebody has, and it doesn't have to be an absolute right to exclude, but if someone has the power in most circumstances to decide who gets to use a resource and who doesn't, and if the courts will give them compensation when their wishes are violated, irrespective of having to prove fault or kind of societal harm, then you know that you have a property right rather than some other type of right. Contrast that with things like contract law, where a violation requires, you know, an agreement in advance between people. So it's more relational. And contrast that with tort law, as you said, or risk management law. It doesn't necessarily have to be common law tort, but whether it's public, you know, statutes or torts, if the idea is that, well, we're setting in advance some expectations about types of risks we don't want to be imposed on society, then we would ask, did someone else's use of this resource cause harm? You know, was it fault blameworthy for the other person to have used it? So using this, you know, I think this applies very easily to things that have a thinginess to them. You know, so if I have a car, it's my car and other people can't use my car because then I wouldn't be able to use it and I wouldn't be able to sort of get the best value out of it. But obviously with non-rivalrous and tangible goods like information or ideas or content of any sort, it gets a little trickier. There are still some good reasons to assign property rights, but there are also some good reasons, as you said in your introductory remarks, to be cautious, because by assigning property rights, you're setting this default that a single person gets to decide what they think the best use is of that item. And it may be, that may be sort of wrong. It may be that other people actually have a much better idea of what to do with that resource, and maybe their interests either conflict or are sort of orthogonal to the original rights holder.
Cool. Alden and Jeff, do you have anything to add to that definition, those distinctions?
I think Jane summarized it very well. I mean, the key thing about property, it sometimes gets tricky because there's a moral dimension, and we may talk about that a little bit later, as well as a purely utilitarian dimension. It's not just what rules allow the maximum output of a certain good or goods or services or expressions thereof for society. It's also, Are we able to protect the rights of individuals to protect what they have created because they don't want others to use it? The right to exclude, as someone was saying, for instance, a trademark owner may have a specific mark that identifies and prevents confusion of good or service, and thus may not want anyone else to use that. There may be an economic reason for that. If others use it but degrade the quality, it can cause confusion. It may lose its value. But at the same time, it's also, there's a moral dimension. I came up with the idea and the thoughts to use this, and I want to control it completely. That's particularly the case in the area of so-called rights of personality, which have existed for about a century or so, and half a century, mainly in state common law and same state statutory law, but they're becoming very important right now. Think of the college athletes playing football and baseball. They are being paid usually by sports supporters of a particular school, large amounts of money to attend the school, and supposedly that's to protect their name, image, and likeness. The idea is that if an individual has invested talents in developing a particular persona, whether it was Michael Jackson or a particular athlete, they have some right to control it. But there are always boundary questions. You know, how far does this right extend? Just as how solidified trademark, going back to trademark, how far does that extend? Yeah, it may be right. You have a right to protect what you develop. But what if you don't police it? For instance, the term Kleenex, the term thermos, used to were trademarks referred to specific inventions by particular parties, but they didn't check. They didn't try to prevent other people from using a term generically. And then they lost control over it. Because the idea is, this is a certain rights you need to maintain control over. And if you don't, the claim that you are preventing confusion and so on, or preventing the or have a right to prevent the benefits of a generic use fall away. So it's tricky. And it really, these questions differ upon it based upon the type of right you're dealing with. For example, copyright doesn't protect ideas. There's many ideas that are very similar about a particular novel, whether it's John Gone with the Wind or Pride and Prejudice, but it protects particular manifestations, particular expressions, very precise expressions of those ideas. I think I'll stop there. There are lots of tricky boundary questions and laws, I think you can already see, in deciding whether a property right is being properly applied in a case or not.
Yeah, I think you touched on something really important there, right? Because we often talk about these things in very kind of utilitarian terms. You know, we need to have these rights so we can encourage investment and economic growth and all that good stuff. But there's also moral dimension, you know, whether it's fairness, sometimes an amorphous concept, giving people control over their own reputations and the value that they bring to, you know, whatever gets generated. So fascinating stuff. Jane, some of your research has focused on calls for the right to publicity, you know, artists who want more control over their image, reputation, those of us who want more control over our own data that we generate when we go onto social media platforms and so on, given how large and profitable these companies are. This bleeds into talk about data privacy rules and sometimes which sometimes seem to treat our data as a quasi privacy right. So could you comment a little bit about, you know, legal movements in this area, whether here or in Europe? And, if not through these sorts of quasi-property rights that give people control, how else might we address these concerns?
Yeah, like picking up on something Alden said, it's true that copyright law does not cover ideas. There needs to be a particular, you know, particularized expression that in order to be copyrightable. But these other areas of law are not quite so strict. And so if the idea is, well, the fact that I visited this particular website and clicked on this, you know, I'm thinking about web browsing data, right? Clicked on this particular link. That is, you could treat it as like a fact or an idea or something that wouldn't be copyrightable. And yet, nevertheless, for kind of instinctive, whether we call it moral or, you know, something else. And the instinct, I think, is for people to say, hey, that's, yeah, it's information, but it's my information. And so a lot of privacy law, it didn't quite start out this way. But for the last few decades, at least, especially with, you know, Europe, I'd say being at the forefront, there's been an eagerness to try to recognize through law that very instinct, that even though this is just, you could treat the right of personality sort of the same way. Like this is what my face looks like. I'm a celebrity, or, you know, I'm a college football player. This is the sort of movement I make. It's not like these games necessarily replicate exactly what they did in a particular game, but the idea is taking on some information that the privacy kind of victim feels like should have been under their control. And so Europe at least has tried to, you know, through the GDPR and other sort of ancillary laws has tried to kind of maximize that control model. There are other ways that a business, there are other justifications for a business to use personal data, but those other justifications are interpreted extremely narrowly, which means that getting consent is the way that, you know, most of the time that the company will be able to do something unusual or new, right? New with the data. And so I've come out sort of critical of this in part because every time you know, every time there's a property interest, whether it's sounding in, you know, sort of moral or economic theory, every time that someone's making a claim to a property interest in some piece of information, it is carving out some liberty interest in someone that someone else might claim, you know, maybe even with the attribute of, you know, sort of moral, the moral high ground. So if I cannot observe or record or share or subsequently use some information about how people browse the internet or in order to, you know, produce new knowledge about the world, then that is in some sense taking away an opportunity from the users of the data that might claim to have a liberty interest.
You know, yeah, one thing also, and it's a good point Jane made, is data. For example, what if people voluntarily provide, say, their birth date, address, some other personal data? Lots of it actually may be discoverable online by third parties, but they're just using it to have access to a certain database. And let's say the users collect that and many other individuals who are browsing anonymize it, but allow that to sort of direct programs to people of a certain age or background, which may actually benefit them more. And they may be willing to. You can also direct ads in a certain way. So in other words, a value has been created. Yes, this information, quote unquote, belongs to a particular person, but it's a third party has created value. So then you get into the question about, has this value creation, how do you weigh that against any privacy rights, particularly when in the online world, many examples of supposedly historically non-public information may be easily obtainable. Because if you create too much of a blockage, then valuable applications, which could benefit a lot of people, consumers and businesses online, can't be developed because of threats of legal liability.
Yeah, I think one problem is that data, the person described in the data does not have a good sense of the likely consequences, both positive and negative. And so this is where I think there is a deviation from at least the economic utilitarian theory of property, where normally we think the person with the resource, they have a lot of, you know, this is like the Hayek model, where they have a lot of inside information that, and so if they know the value and they know the value of giving it away as well, that's not as true, or at least I think the transaction cost, the information cost of figuring out what your life is going to be like if you do or do not let companies track you. It's very hard for consumers, or really anyone, to know with great certainty. But people do tend to undervalue what they get back, as Alden said, from some of these tracking activities.
Yeah, I think those are really interesting points. And also, I mean, you know, you touched on something important there, which is the implicit assumption that the property rights holder will know how to best use the property. I can think of a number of examples where, you know, maybe that isn't literally true, right? You know, where, you know, often people who own a property will kind of, I mean, they own a share in it or so on through maybe an intermediary, and then they pay for those services for it to be managed. There are asset management firms and so on. I mean, to your point, though, you know, with regard to data, I mean, I think there is an argument to be made that the economic utility of the data is in most cases not in that individual piece of data itself, you know, the way like a drop of oil is one small share in a big barrel of oil, right? It seems to be more so aggregating it and turning it into something that has utility, which in most cases is what the platform would normally be doing. And of course, you know, there isn't that same economic incentive for someone to pay for someone to have the best use of their data. That's how it seems to me anyway. But thanks a lot for that. You know, one of the interesting things also that you mentioned, property rights often come down to, you know, is there a thinginess to the thing, if it's tangible or intangible? And some intangible things are thinginess that others don't. I'm reading now, you know, some articles arguing that we should change our copyright law and recognize copyright in artistic style, because AI tools have now allowed you to create an algorithm that can arguably quantify the style of a Drake or a Taylor Swift, which I find interesting. I'm not personally convinced, but there are some interesting movements in this space. With that in mind, I'd like to move on to a controversial topic that's being widely discussed nowadays. The use of the creation of generative AI tools and training them, often using the sum total of human knowledge, including copyrighted works. So, for Jeff, quote unquote, information yearns to be free, right? AI tools are often just, some would argue, more efficient at doing what humans do, learning patterns, assimilating info, and producing creative outputs. Now, we hold humans liable for violating copyright if they release art, music, or books that replicate the existing works without permission, not for studying and learning from those works. So why should we treat AI tools differently by extending copyrights to the training?
Well, I struggle with a lot of the current discussion on this topic, because it's always limited to a sort of a descriptive or positive perspective. And to me, the better discussion is more of a normative perspective. In other words, I don't necessarily disagree that under the current sort of fair use regime that you can certainly make a strong argument that, that this is fair use. But again, my question, again, is from a different perspective, is should it be? Should we be utilizing copyrighted works? Should we be utilizing the works of authors, without compensation? And it implicates, a number of concerns I have, particularly in the IP space, about, the separation of powers issues, and whether, we should be leaving so much of this to the courts. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, gives plenary power to Congress to set these rules. And yet, we have, again, and to the point that you brought up in the copyright, the transformative use, training data, it's all on this sort of, again, on transformative use, which is, again, is entirely a court created construct. It was from comes back from the early 90s from a judge who wrote a law review article, and it was picked up by Justice Souter in the Campbell case. And all of a sudden, boom, there it is. It's now where in transformative, the word transformative does not appear in the statute anywhere. It's entirely a judge-made construct that, and what's happened is what always happens when judges and the courts get involved where they shouldn't be, is it just expands, right? And now it's just consumed and subsumed the entire, debate, and if we just sort of go back to sort of first principles, founding principles, which, that's sort of my perspective, and why, to my, answer to your initial question, the title of the the webinar here is, my answer is, early and often, property rights should be found early and often. I'm a student of the Austrian school. And I think, that kind of, is essential for the market to create value, is creating those property rights expansively and early and simply, and allowing the market process to take its, to do what it does and allow the parties to adapt. And I don't think we're sort of giving ourselves enough opportunity. But again, getting back to, the transformative copyright case, in my view, the proper analysis, is going back to the statute, where the statute talks about the nature and the fair use factors, the nature and purpose of the use. Well, this is as commercial a use as you can possibly get, but we never seem to talk about that in the discussion of whether this is fair use. So it always jumps to the judge made doctrine of is it transformative or not? My view is, that's not the way to go. And we're depriving these authors, these innovators, these rights holders of proper compensation. for their work. And frankly, I think in the long run, we're harming ourselves, because if you find a way to compensate these people the way that, you know, based on the way the system is set up, you're going to get more of what they do. And that's going to benefit all of us. And that's going to benefit, you know, the AI industry, or, you know, and this applies in the patent space as well. You're going to get more, you know, innovation, which is, again, what we all say we all want. And if they're properly compensated, they're going to do more work, they're going to generate more, and that's going to benefit where we need to go. And again, and you know, I have no desire to hold back the AI industry. I believe wholeheartedly that we need to win this race. We need to be the leader, and we need to innovate there. But there ought to be a way to respect these folks' property rights in a way, again, that, again, respects them and incentivizes them to do more, which is going to be feed for a better outcome on the users of this data, the large language model creators. And, you know, and so I think that, again, there, if we set some simple categorical rules here, the parties will adapt. We have seen many license agreements take place for the use of this data. So this, it can be done. And as I always say, we found a way to compensate, you know, a recording artist when their songs are played, streamed on the internet. We can figure out a way for some reasonable compensation to authors. Again, they're not going to get rich off of this, but it will show that we're respecting their property rights, and it will create, you know, certainly no disincentive to do more, which is, I think, is what we really want out of the system here. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, where how I think about, anyway, you know, sort of, you know, the use of copyrighted materials in the large language model training setting.
Right.
Go ahead, Dalton.
You know, the Supreme Court in 2021 and 6-2 ruled that Google is copying of 11,500 lines of Java API developed by Oracle was fair use because it was transformative. It allowed Google programmers to use familiar skills to create new smartphone apps. Well, you know, they could have easily entered into a licensing agreement with Google. And there were a number of commentators who said there's a huge amount of copyright more competitive here. This was no less than theft. And calling it a transformative use, this was just a tiny bit. This was a huge amount. And it created huge value for Google. But Oracle wasn't allowed to share in that value.
You know, I might come around eventually in a second to agree with you both, and especially you, Jeff. But I actually still, though, I'm struggling a little bit with the conceptually with this. It's if you're talking purely about cases that could be brought against an AI company based on output that is whether transformative or not, a copy, then everything you said makes sense to me. But a lot of these claims are not about the output. They're about the input of training the model. And in that sense, if we're kind of going to, you know, do our analogy to the humans, it's like saying that because I've read Shakespeare, and if I later at some, you know, in some even unknown to me way sort of process that and wound up writing a totally different story about star-crossed lovers, but didn't use that phrase, that itself is some sort of is some sort of violation of the Copyright Act. And I don't see that. So I'm wondering. So what I'm struggling though with is that you're right though that if there's no recognition of the value of input training data of the, you know, rights holders for input training data. Thinking about the New York Times case in particular, it means that all of this work, all of this expensive work that they do with investigative journalism can just be dumped into an LLM, and the knowledge is kind of extracted in this, you know, in this sort of mysterious way, and the output will never be a copy. And so they sort of, I see the incentive problem, but I mean, just a straight up application of the copyright statute, I don't see how you get from the statute we have today to liability based on input data, input only.
I guess, you know, my thought is, again, you know, they're clearly making a copy of the work, which is one of the rights protected by the statute. And it's certainly the expression that matters, because they create these vectors off of the actual specific expression that the author used. That's how the vectors are created. What word order? So it's to me, it's essentially what copyright is designed to protect. And I struggle with this whole, you know, the law, as we know, always lags, right? So, you know, this fair use has been around for almost 200 years. You know, it was codified in 76. And then the courts got involved and expanded it. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, applying it as a 50-year-old statute and a 200-year-old doctrine, you know, it needs to be updated, adapt to the current use and to respect property rights. And again, I don't think it is. That's why, again, I really think this is a more of a normative discussion. What should it be? And we should not be taking people's work without compensation. That's just anti the American experiment, our founding principles, back to the Declaration, which again is how I look at this stuff, requires that these rights be protected, be respected, and be compensated. And the other issue I just want to point out, again, it was my concern, where I recoil over this transformative use analysis that we just focus on so much today, is, you know, implicit in that is what is there's always like a second work, a specific second work that we're talking about, whether there was transformation. Well, what is that in the LLM training module context? It just doesn't fit very well. So again, I just don't think that, you know, this debate around a positive analysis of the current transformative use, fair use regime makes a lot of sense. And it's leading us down the wrong road, in my view.
Yeah, just to sort of interject briefly, I think one area where fair use makes clearly the most sense is parodies of transformations to make fun of, to critique other works. Those clearly have very, very strong First Amendment interests at stake, because if you don't allow people to parody or to make political or other critique of work out there, you are really limiting their First Amendment right very, very severely. And that one could argue, I think that's something very, that a copying of code or something, or thousands of lines of code, which is doesn't rise to the sort of involve the same First Amendment position. And then of course the question, I'm not going to say anything more about the copying used in training, but clearly, I mean, yeah, fair use clearly has some strong First Amendment implications, but you should be careful how those are bounded.
Yeah, I think that those are some great arguments going both ways. You know, Jane, I'm sympathetic to many of the points you made. And I think similar arguments have been made to defend, you know, the rights of these companies to train their models and copyrighted works. But what I find, you know, a lot of these arguments do rest on a proposition, right? The proposition that these tools, because that's what they are, these machine tools, do we perhaps tend to anthropomorphize them a little too much? You know, the AI is hallucinating. The AI is learning. Humans learn too, but in a very different way, right? I mean, in the recent cases that are winding their way through the courts on the subject, I thought it was interesting when, a lot of the focus seems to be on the replication of the work. Are you creating perhaps a database that can then be used for future training, and have you given proper, you know, attribution for that purpose? I forgot the name of the case, but that was one of the points made by the judge recently against Anthropic. But I want to move on to another notion that frequently pops up in these cases. There's this huge debate around what is or isn't transformative. In a recent case where the judge ruled against the rights holders suing the AI company, they flagged this idea that market dilution is going to be a very significant consideration going forward. To what degree is allowing this use of copyright material going to dilute the market for those works? This is kind of an analogous point to the idea of monopsony power? Are we suppressing the value of future output and innovation, which is one of the ideas behind having IP law? So the question, you know, for anyone who wants to jump in on it, are we seeing any evidence one way or the other that these AI tools are diluting the market for original ideas, you know, through the production of, I think, what people derisively call slop?
I mean, I don't know that you're asking an empirical question. I haven't kept up with it's an interesting question. It's the right question, I guess, is how I want to respond. That it's taking seriously this idea that one of the core, maybe not the only, but one of the main missions of copyright and other IP laws is to make sure that the incentives for future generation are still there. And I could imagine, I mean, I think one reason I don't even want to speculate about what might be happening empirically is that I could see it going either way. I could see AI bringing just a wealth of new creators, you know, who now have this tool that allow them to kind of meet the maximum potential of their creativity. And or I could imagine the opposite, that, you know, there's what's the point?
Yeah, I think that's the key way to think about this I recoil at the debate constantly about, oh, whether is AI an author or AI an inventor? You know, to me, that's the wrong question. You know, the answer is no, they're never. It's never going to be an author. It's never going to be an inventor. It always goes back to the closest human, the human that's utilizing the tool, as you mentioned. You know, they're always going to be the inventor and the author. And, you know, and that we should encourage that, because that will embrace the utilization of these tools in a way that's sort of low risk. It's not going to eliminate their livelihood, you know, because that's the concern, right? You're going to have, AI is going to go and generate all these, you know, all these new novels that we won't ever have to read. Pick your favorite author anymore, because we'll have all this stuff available to us so cheaply and ubiquitously. We only get there if we think about it in the wrong way, in my view. If we bring it back to there's always a human, they're the key, they're utilizing the tool, we'll get more and better works. We'll get more and better inventions. But, you know, at the same time, we're not going to, again, disincentivize or eliminate the livelihoods of innovators that we rely on. America was built on innovators. We must be respectful. We must provide an environment where they can grow and prosper and, you know, be fruitful and multiply. That's what we want. It's essential for national security, for economic security, for everything that we do. So we have to think about this stuff the right way, and thinking about ever that an AI can by itself be an author or an inventor, in my view, is absurd and problematic.
Yeah, I think, you know, judges, those are excellent points everyone's making. Intelligent judges can parse through the copyright law. One can argue about what amendments and come to some intelligent decisions. I think thinking Bartsch v. Anthropic, where the judge Alsop in the Northern District of California held using books to train Claude was exceedingly transformative in fair use. Why? It had scanned lawfully purchased books into a digital internal library, which was not multiplied or redistributed, but it did inform this the development of Claude. However, the court separated that from the acquisition and retention of books. For instance, its creation of a permanent library from pirated copies was not fair use. The court stated there was no AI company carve-out from the Copyright Act and set the pirated copy issue for trial on damages. So, you know, you could read that as, well, training may be fair use when the model does not create output infringing copies, but stealing or retaining pirated source copies is a separate infringement problem. It is infringement. So I'm not saying he necessarily got it right on the first one, but the courts can settle, can go through this. And of course, eventually some of these issues are going to get to the Supreme Court, perhaps. And I know Jeff, from what Jeff has said, and I also might have a little concern, The problem is the Supreme Court has not been very great on property rights in general. We haven't talked about patent, but I think the Supreme Court shockingly has ignored the plain statutory language of Section 101 of the Patent Act to find that certain highly novel inventions were not patentable. And it just made absolutely no sense, but there we are. So sometimes Congress does have to step in and clear things up.
Thanks. Those are great points. And, I do want to move on to patents in a second. But before I do that, I want to quickly get response on this question. So the National AI Framework has recently been put out by the Trump administration. Obviously, the goal is to encourage American innovation and give American companies an edge in the AI race. One of the things they've quite diplomatically tried to do is sidestep these debates about the fair use question and say, we'll leave that answer up to the courts. There are plans right now to amend the copyright law. So my question for the panel would be, what, if any, amendments should we make to the copyright law in order to address these sorts of issues that are being brought up? Because Jeff, to your point, I do think while the economic question can be a little bit murky and based on evidence that might not exist yet and hard to argue in each separate case, I think the normative or moral case is probably going to be what dictates any future reform in this area. But yeah, what amendments, you guys make?
I mean, again, I think the bigger question is, I believe the democratic process should play out here, but Congress must set simple categorical rules. Whatever they are, that is most important. My personal view is that it should be, in the particular case that we've been discussing here, that it should be defined as infringement. It should be infringement to utilize copyrighted works to train large language models without compensation, in my view. But again, I don't get to make that decision. I'm comfortable letting but I think the more important from a political economy, from a property rights perspective, what have you, is we just need simple categorical rules, because leaving it murky, leaving it complicated up to the courts, as we've discussed here in both the copyright, as Alden, talked about in the patent space, leaving it to the courts is a disaster. And it all we do is just, increase litigation and create confusion. And again, like running home to my, belief in the process of innovation and the discovery process that is in the subjectivity that is the core of Austrian economics. If we do that, the parties will adapt. We need to believe and understand that that will happen. If we just have the sort of institutional courage to follow the Constitution, follow the separation of powers, set the rules, and then get out of the way and let the market drive the adoption, the adaptation, and the country will be better off for it, in my view.
Alden?
No, I really can't disagree with Jeff. I think particularly the patent area, that's important. And, maybe some clear language on what is fair use, let's say, copying certain things, but very clear categories perhaps could be helpful. I think the problem that the patents is even most important because there's a huge amount of innovation driven by patents, but there are things, medical diagnostics, for example, are patentable in China and Germany. But because the court has had some weird interpretations about what are abstract ideas, well, these are just applying to it, that and a few other important areas. You've lost. Some foreign investors have gone to China to do work on medical diagnostics because they thought it was too complicated and risky to try and get patents, defensible patents in the U.S. That's a terrible situation to be in. And unfortunately, the public choice people would say you've got rent-seeking coalitions. You've got the people who are using this property without having to go through licensing and so on are going to lobby against that. But this is very, very important, I think, in terms of international innovation and for the role of the U.S. that the patent law gets straightened out by Congress.
So, you know, with regard to that, right, one of the debates we're having right now is around subject matter eligibility. Now, it's rare to find a court that has said blanket, you know, you cannot patent this technology or that technology or this innovation or that innovation. Rather, they will do it in case-by-case basis that, in effect, makes it very difficult to patent certain things. So, for example, it is possible but difficult to patent a business method. It is really very difficult to patent, from what I've read, a medical diagnostic tool. So the question is, if we do expand this subject matter eligibility, perhaps through statute, would there be any negative law implications in terms of holding up innovation?
In my view, no. It would be pouring gasoline on our, injecting gasoline into the innovation engine. You know, again, the subject matter eligibility issue is the poster child for courts meddling where they have no business meddling, and the problems that is created are directly a result of, again, violation, in my view, of the separation of powers. Congress has plenary power to set the rules for patenting. They did it with a simple categorical rule in the text of Section 101, and here come the courts, say, well, wait a minute, you know, those four statutory categories, we have to have some exceptions to that. And look at what that mess has created. And so, you know, by statute, the statutory change, in my view, would be to eliminate, abrogate all those judicial exceptions and just go back to the statute as written. Everybody can understand that. I've suggested, you know, in the meanwhile, to the Federal Society conference in November, to the director of the patent office, you know, given this clear violation of separation of powers, where the judiciary is writing patent law in subject matter eligibility context, you know, have you considered taking their opinions as advisory? Hey, okay, thank you. We'll look at that. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to interpret we're Article II agency. We can interpret that statute, and we appreciate your opinion, but we'll make the call as to whether to cancel the patent or not. You know, this is the kind of thing that it just illustrates again, you know, the problems that are created when courts go outside their lane and start to, again, violate separation of powers, in my view.
Maybe I'll weigh in to, you know, try to find a little bit of separation or controversy between us. So I'm highly sympathetic to some of the examples that have come out, like the medical diagnosis devices, for example. And I mentioned news gathering earlier. Like there are certain types of even raw information that today isn't even copyrightable that I think we have a serious incentive problem. But my concern is that, you know, what those things have in common is that it's surfacing information that's hard to extract otherwise. It takes effort or ingenuity, and it's highly useful. And so then the problem of free riding is right there. And so I think we all are interested in solving that. But on the other side, when I think about who would be lobbying Congress for these changes, if I think of what the RIAA does, it's like, do we really need more incentive for people to become celebrities and recording artists? I actually don't think we do. And perhaps, you know, maybe Jeff and I could compromise where maybe if the terms of copyright are changed or, you know, modified to kind of fit in categorical terms how much other sort of psychic rewards or how much other incentive there is for people to produce, you know, maybe it would make sense, I think, to expand rights, but I do worry a bit, speaking of political economy, about who exactly is going to be there, ready to get their sort of favored terms.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because leaving aside the moral question of, you know, compensating people for their effort and for their creativity, to me it seems like if an AI tool can ingest the sum total of your works and produce something generic that replicates them in a way that's as good as something you yourself are continuing to put out, that's probably a sign that you as an artist need to do something different, something more, or you know, or perhaps your art or your style happens to be a particularly generic one. And with that being said, for all the talk about AI slop, I do think there's a lot of human slop out there. You know, Mumble Rap is an example, but I mean, that's just, you know, I'm biased on this topic. So, you know, I do think that there is an argument, at least on the economics side, leaving aside the question of compensation for the use of IP, that these tools will, in the long run, perhaps encourage more creativity, because you now know what the generic version of something sounds like. And that makes it easier to get to, okay, what's innovative? What's new? Mm. What's next? What can I add to the total that now exists? All right, so we're going to move on to audience questions. There's some interesting questions here. So the opinion in Sauter, move the court away from a purely commercial focus. This is a question from Dr. Jack David Golub. Move the court away from a purely commercial focus towards determining if a new work supersedes the original or creates something of value for the public. Is this not analogous to the patent law embodying the novelty doctrine? Feel free to jump in if anyone has.
Analogous to patent law, I guess I'm just not exactly seeing what the specific analogy here. Maybe I missed that, but I mean,
so if it's creating a new market, basically, because it's doing something that goes beyond, you may be embedding, but goes beyond. Is that, I don't know enough about patent law, so trying to help translate.
Was the question about creating a new work that it is, you know, sort of sufficiently different than the previous work? Kind of like, is it the analogy to obviousness? Yeah. Is that what I'm understanding? Yeah. I mean, again, you have this substantially similar doctrine in copyright, right? Before you can infringe. I guess that's something to think about it in that context. I don't know. In copyright, right? It's about the expression. So, you know, if you express the idea in a different way, that's a different work. You know, and it's entitled.
Do you think derivative work, the concept of derivative works, might be too broad? If we compare how patent law, right, maybe that's kind of the essence of the question. If we compare how patent law deals with new kind of add-ons, does that imply that maybe derivative works, the scope of derivative works is too broad?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly there's a right, you have a right to, as a copyright holder, to come up with derivative works. In patents, it's somewhat different. People can use, the big thing about patent law, they can use the information. The public can use the information disclosed. That is one of the arguments as to why patents may be socially superior to trade secrets. They allow that information out there, but people are allowed to use that information to come out and say, well, their own patents, which are, but they have to be novel. They have to be, you know, not based on, substantially based on prior art. They have to go beyond that. So you have to show your own form of novelty, and you may be able to get your own patent. Just as a patent holder may not a derivative work, but may have a follow-on patent that has to meet the conditions of patentability. Say the way you change the way a drug may be chemically injected. If it's obvious, you can't do that, but you may be able to come up with some changes that allow you for new patents. So again, there's sort of an analogy, but it's not. Doesn't really work the same way as a derivative works, because the two statutory schemes are fairly different.
Cool. We have a question on copyright terms. Any opinion on whether copyright terms are too long? Isn't a limited time properly determined as a portion of human life? Otherwise, if there is no quid pro quo, a person in their 20s today will never see fair use of copyrighted materials they spend money on, in theory. But in theory, by the time someone in their 20s today should see fair use of today's data, by the time they're 50. I want to expand the question a little bit. Does the panel have thoughts on the current duration for copyright terms as well as patent?
Again, you know, they're currently simple and categorical. We know what they are. You know, they've been a little bit muddled in the patent space, you know, things, you know, with extensions and adjustments and obviousness type double patenting, which again, mostly judge made meddling that have caused those problems. But again, you know, I get back to that, you know, as long as they're simple and categorical, you know, I can live with whatever they are. The market process, the market will adapt based on whatever we decide as a you know, as a body politic that they should be. But that's the key. Don't complicate them. Don't have a bunch of exceptions. Don't have, you know, different terms for different kinds of works, you know, or if you do, have to be very clear and very straightforward.
Yeah, the Supreme Court did address the issue: is can there be something too long of a term? It was this infamous Mickey Mouse case. I think Disney had lobbied to get an extension, well, with 75 years beyond the term of death, and because they wanted to preserve copyrights for some early Mickey Mouse cartoons and copyrighted.
Yeah, they went around the market with that one. Went around the market straight to Congress.
That was a matter of lobbying, but the court basically did not say, we can tell that it's no longer limited. Now, if you had a 1,000-year term or 10,000-year term, that might be, but correct me if I'm wrong, Jane, was it 75 or was that the magic amount? The court refused to opine and suggest that was not limited.
Right.
So there's a question about how much of a human contribution to creative work should enable the user of an AI tool to be named as an author of something original. And on the patent side, will the test be, quote, substantial contribution under the Panu case or conception of all claim limitations under the Singh case? It appears that in many cases, no human will satisfy the criteria, and thus the property right will be invalidated as not being the product of a human. Thoughts?
I mean, I remarked on this during the panel. I think this is the wrong way to think about it. You know, we need to sort of state unequivocally that, you know, AI tools cannot be on their own authors and inventors. They are always tools. There's always a human, and you just have to find that human and make them, him or her, the author or the inventor. And then this debate goes away, and we, you know, energize innovation, because we are allowing the tools that we have available to us to be used in their most effective and their maximized way. Just like, you know, when we invented, you know, different laboratory equipment or other things to help the discovery of new pharmaceuticals, or, you know, we invented the personal computer to help authors, you know, put their work on paper. You know, these kinds of things, you know, are again, they're tools to drive to assist the human innovator. And that's the way it needs to be thought about. We should not be debating and say, you know, if you just say no, this is not going to happen. We're not going to do this. This is not possible. This is not how we think of it. It's always the human, and the AI is the tool.
Jeff, do you think, though, that there might be some instances where the human contributions are so diffuse or indirect that we should just treat the output as immediately within the public domain? So I'm thinking about there are some hacker groups right now that are using AI to just generate a whole bunch of patent ideas or copyrightable, you know, expression, and they're not, you know, using them. They just are creating these giant bodies. So, you know, if something's automated enough, do you think that maybe we should recognize no author and no inventor?
Well, you know, yeah, there's always an issue of nefarious actors getting in, and we do worry about that in the patent space, about generating a bunch of prior art, you know, right, that could undermine the ability to, you know, to get inventions, you know, patented. But I think There's a better way to deal with that, aside from, again, claiming that the AI is the author and then it's not eligible, because I think we're seeing where that leads to. And it's too messy. There's better ways to handle, that kind of, sort of computer generated art through the examination process. And that's kind of how I would address that.
All right. We're almost right at time. Thank you all so much for what's been a really great, insightful discussion. And looking forward to the next one.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for presenting on today's program, for sharing your expertise and opinions on this really important topic. And thank you to Satya for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website. That is fedsoc.org, fedsoc.org, or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.